This is On Being's Unheard Cuts. I'm Krista Tippett. You're listening to my unedited conversation with scientist and writer Jon Kabat-Zinn. He's the founding director of the Stress Reduction Clinic and the Center for Mindfulness in Medicine, Healthcare, and Society at the University of Massachusetts Medical School. I spoke with him on March 26, 2009, from the studios of APM in St. Paul, Minnesota. He was in the studios of WGBH in Boston. This interview is included in our show, Opening to Our Lives, Jon Kabat-Zinn's Science of Mindfulness. Download the MP3 of that produced show at onbeing.org. Watching the talks you gave at MIT and at Google, and that's kind of the kind of conversation I want to have with you.
Are they on the on YouTube? Is that what you
Yes, I got them. My producers found them online.
I didn't even know the MIT talk was on.
Yeah, and I just loved it. And I think we could put that on the air, and it would be a public service, and you don't need me. But here we are. We're going to have a conversation about it. And, you know, here we are at this moment in our culture where there's a lot of things have come to a head, I think. And,
I
think that's what we're going to do. I want to talk about the things you've done for years and that you know and that you think about and talk about all the time, but focus it a bit in terms of where we are. And I think
Sounds
it'll be very helpful for me and eventually for our listeners.
You know, just before we get started, even I wrote this book a few years ago called Coming to Our Senses, and I meant it, both literally and metaphorically. And, you know, now in a sense we're seeing the fallout from years of not really being in touch with the full dimensionality of what we were doing.
Yeah, that's right. We've been doing a project that started online, and I actually see this conversation as part of its trajectory, of which we're calling Repossessing Virtue.
Wonderful.
And we're trying to look at moral and spiritual aspects of the economic crisis and living through it and beyond it. And
wonderful.
Maybe we'll talk about that a little bit. We've gone back to people.
I'll follow your lead in some way.
Yeah.
And then you should also, just to say, I mean, I'm one of those kinds of people that if I get talking, I can just talk.
So, yeah, well,
feel free to just get in there with a crowbar.
I will.
Wrench me in a different direction if you need to.
I'll do that. But the great luxury of this, of first of all, having an hour of radio that's not broken up by
wonderful.
Commercials and then getting to have a much longer time to speak is that I can let you go on sometimes and then I can later.
I will try not to abuse that privilege.
Okay. Let's see. I'm getting a hand behind the glass.
I just have to correct the pronunciation I gave you before. Iyer.
All right. I'd like to start with you. You know, I interview theologians and scientists and artists and physicians, all kinds of people. I always start the interview by asking whether there was a religious background to your life, to your childhood.
Well, I suppose there was some background that could be called religious to my childhood, but it's not what one would imagine if one were to hear the words religious background.
Okay, well, what do you think of?
In the sense that, you know, I was born into a family that's ethnically Jewish, but that didn't practice at all. I was not bar mitzvahed and never set foot in a synagogue until I was 13, and some of my friends from school were bar mitzvahed. So I was not brought up in the Jewish tradition, although I certainly, you know, recognize myself as being Jewish, but I didn't have that kind of conventional exposure, so to speak, to a particular tradition and what its doctrines and practices were.
Okay.
On the other hand, I grew up in New York City in Washington Heights in a very sort of diverse community in the late 40s and early to mid 50s. And so I grew up, although I was Jewish, I grew up with a lot of Catholics. And I went to a public school where, you know, most of the kids were Jewish or not Catholic. And then mostly I played in the streets with kids who were Catholic and had their own ideas about Jews and other faiths and so forth. And I didn't take any of it personally because I didn't identify with any of it. But as I got older, it had a very interesting texture to it, and I was certainly conscious of that growing up.
Okay, and then you studied molecular biology, is that right? As an undergraduate,
yes.
Also?
Well, I went no. As an undergraduate, I went to Haverford College outside okay. of Philadelphia when it was a very small school with only 450 students and 100 professors. Yeah. So it was really quite unusual. And I came from the Lycée Henri IV in Paris, which was one of the top three lycées in France and still is. And so I went to college when I had just turned 16, which put me 2 years ahead of the curve. And so that was a very interesting experience. And I wound up majoring in chemistry, not biology, because I felt like I wanted to get as, you know, grounded a foundation in both physics and chemistry before I went into the life sciences, biology, and so forth.
Okay.
And I also took a kind of informal, not formal, but informal second major in comparative literature. So I was, you know, reading French and German and Italian and doing all sorts, and of course English, and doing all sorts of things at the interface between the sciences and the humanities.
Sounds wonderful. So how and when did you start thinking about, or did you discover meditation and mindfulness? How did that happen?
Well, I've done a certain amount of reflecting on that, and some of it involves even the kind of impossibility of defining too highly any one trajectory in answer to a question like that. It's a little bit like, you know, the indeterminacy that you get into with the uncertainty principle in quantum physics. It's not that we don't tell ourselves all sorts of stories, stories about where we started out and so forth, but they're more stories that lull us to sleep or make us feel comfortable than anything else. Sometimes I begin by saying that, you know, I was born into a family where my father was a very highly recognized world-class molecular immunologist and what was called in those days immunochemist. And won lots of awards for his work, had a tremendous reputation, was a scientist, as many of his colleagues put it. One of his students win the Nobel Prize. And then my mother was a painter and still is to this day. And she's turning 95 in a couple of weeks. And she was as prolific as a painter as my father was in writing scientific papers and training graduate students and postdocs and so forth. But she was completely unrecognized and didn't even participate, I don't think, in an art show until she was about 93 or something like that. So I grew up in the classical C.P. Snow's two cultures, the culture of the science and the culture of art. Basically I was born into that. And so as a child, I was, you know, it's inevitable that you have your eyes open and you're kind of taking the lay of the land. And some of it involved seeing these different ways of knowing the world through the eyes of a painter and through the eyes, if you will, of a biological experimenter, chemist. And they're very different. And so I think from a very, very early age, on some level, long before I could actually articulate it, I was interested in the unity behind the divergences between those different ways of seeing or epistemologies.
Right.
And that just developed as I got older, which is one reason why I was so interested in the arts and as well as the sciences when I was in college. And the year that I spent at the Lycée in Paris was like a renaissance year for me because, you know, although I'd gone to Stuyvesant High School in New York City and got 100 on the New York State Regents exam in geometry, I found that when I went into the 11th grade at the Lycée in Paris, I was already 5 years behind in geometry. and every other subject, including English, I might say. So it was the first time that I ever really felt like I was being completely challenged, and my intellect and my heart just soared in response to the experience. And that's why I went to college at the end of that year rather than the dreaded possibility of going back even to a really great elite high school.
Right.
So all of these threads, I mean, the reason I'm telling you this is that all of these were actually extremely germane. I'm sorry. All of these threads were extremely germane to finding my way into the meditative practices and contemplative practices, because in a sense, I realized in retrospect later that they were a potential path for unifying what Wordsworth called discordant elements.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, sort of like between the arts and the sciences.
But did you, I mean, you didn't know that. You didn't even know about meditation. You probably hadn't
heard
that.
Well, when I was in college, I took a world history class and I learned about the desert fathers and monastics and so forth in the Middle Ages. And there was a resonance there, even, you know, when I was like in my mid-teens or mid to late teens. There was some idea that, oh, you could go off and Descartes, actually, at least I don't know if this is true, but at the time I thought that Descartes had taken 10 years and just gone someplace and sat in silence. Mm-hmm. And of course, Pascal is famous for saying all man's problems stem from his inability to sit alone in a room by himself. So there was this notion that that silence and reflection could actually tap into deep sources of understanding and wisdom that don't come necessarily in the traditional ways to the intellect.
Okay.
And so that was just, again, a little sort of thread in this whole thing.
And then I think you've said that you actually started to meditate at MIT, right?
Yes,
which is such an interesting sentence.
That in itself
especially
is
especially 30 years ago or whatever, 35 years
ago.
Yeah, uh-huh.
And the story, which I wrote up in Coming to Our Senses, in part because I put a lot of my own personal story into Coming to Our Senses, and some of it's actually in various books, because I want people to understand that when they come to meditation, that it doesn't mean that you give up being a person and you become some kind of, I don't know, transparent weirdo of sorts, mm-hmm. but that you change your relationship to who you think you are as a person, and in particular to the story of who you are or think you are.
And it seems to me that you spend a fair amount of your time, and I suspect as much in your speaking as in your writing, kind of demystifying meditation and mindfulness, and also, you know, is saying that it's not squishy. In fact, presenting it as you found it, as a spiritual technology that has some kindred that can be akin to some of the creativity and openness to experience that you love about science, or the science.
Oh, absolutely,
enables.
And mm-hmm. art. Mm-hmm. Yeah, in fact, I stay away from even the word spiritual. So it's not so much that I'm into demystifying meditation as it is as I'm into trying to make it so commonsensical to people that they will slap the side of the head and say, well, of course, why the hell didn't I know that like 30 years ago?
Right, right.
That makes total sense.
Right.
Because it's often freighted, even the word meditation is freighted with so much cultural baggage and so much really ideological baggage and sort of belief baggage that the essential beauty of it is often really not apparent to people until long after they've somehow wandered into the domain of it. And my feeling was, you know, if what the Buddha said was true and that this is a path that is potentially leads to the freedom from suffering, and if everybody on the planet is basically suffering, why shouldn't it be accessible to virtually everybody on the planet, as opposed to those people who self-identify as, say, Buddhists or as, you know, yogis or people who are into this or that?
Mm-hmm.
And so I tried to create a kind of glide path into meditation that would be so commonsensical and accessible and based on what people really need and also fear and are challenged by, that we could at least empirically test whether, if it was framed in that kind of way, regular mainstream Americans would take to meditation. And in fact, I think the proof after 30 years is pretty much in the pudding that we do.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, let's do that. Let's talk about this as a what you know as common sense wisdom, and let's talk about it in the context of our culture right now, where there's a lot of stress,
okay.
There's a lot of stress, and there's perhaps a heightened awareness that we haven't been as mindful or aware. And so it's a moment of interesting positive possibilities as well.
I agree with you. I think that it's what is called sometimes a really fecund moment for learning. You know, that it's there's some kind of profound learning available to us at this moment, because we get to actually see and feel, and I would say globally, most people in certainly the first and second worlds get to see and feel how much the consequences of certain kinds of lack of paying attention or of unbridled greed in the form of, you know, capitalism doing its thing leads to a certain kind of disaster that has effects on virtually everybody who are in some degree innocent to what was going on with, say, the banks and the mortgage companies and that kind of thing.
You know, I don't think that you talk about Buddhism as a religion, and certainly the Buddha didn't consider himself a religious leader.
Well, he didn't. He wasn't a Buddhist.
Or he wasn't a Buddhist, sure. Right?
Yeah.
And Jesus wasn't a Christian either.
Right.
So
I've said that on the air before too.
Okay. So
on TV.
But Buddhism is one of these, you know, like we can call it a religious and spiritual tradition.
Well, there's no question about it.
Yeah. And so we've been talking to a number of people for this project we're calling Repossessing Virtue. And one of the people we called up was Sharon Salzberg, who's been on the program before. I'm sure you know her.
Yeah, and we're close friends.
Right. And so this is one of these moments where, you know, one of the things that's clear to me as we look at as the economy started falling apart is the trust we had placed in things that we assumed were logical and rational, and in fact were highly irrational. Also how at a moment like this, so Sharon Salzberg makes a comment that in fact is so much more reality-based than our economic expectations and behavior for the last few years. She said, you know, as a Buddhist, you know, change and suffering are inevitable parts of life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's something we kind of forgot in these boom years. And we are so shocked that things can change and that we can suffer. So, you know, what I'm interested in, and you just talked about greed a moment ago, but I think what you know about is, you know, that's kind of an easy word to use, but what is behind that? I remember I've been reading you the last few days. You know, you talk about this greed to make is kind of this impulse to make ourselves feel better, right? It's part of the human condition, but it has these terrible, sometimes quite evil consequences. So talk to me about what we've been doing as you understand that, both through the science that you do and the work that you do on stress. Just how you've been
analyzing
this. Well,
it's a very broad question, so I'll have to start somewhere and just thread my way around,
that.
And you can help guide me.
Okay.
Maybe I should start, for the purposes of the listening audience, by saying a little bit about what I do, and then expanding the context of it to include the present situation that we find ourselves in this country and globally. So for the past 30 years, and we just celebrated the 30th anniversary of it, in 1979, I founded a clinic at the University of Massachusetts Medical Center in Worcester, Massachusetts, called the Stress Reduction Clinic. And what we do in that clinic and have done for 30 years now is what's called mindfulness-based stress reduction. And it's basically taking fairly intensive Buddhist meditative practices and offering them to mainstream medical patients and people who are experiencing stress, pain, and illness in their lives. and doing science on it so that we could carefully monitor outcomes and then begin to do randomized clinical trials and then even neuroscience studies and biological mechanism studies so that we're beginning to sort of develop a body of evidence, not just at the University of Massachusetts Medical Center, but now throughout the world This model has spread around the world so that there is a really quite significant and very rapidly growing base of evidence that's suggesting that how you pay attention in your life actually can change your life and your biology and your brain. Mm-hmm. And it's in a direction of liberation. It's in a direction of freeing ourselves from some of the profound automatic pilot habits that we can fall into that create a certain degree of blindness, insensitivity, a drifting out of touch, and a kind of zoning along on autopilot that can last for a very long time, especially if your expectations basically are being fulfilled over that period of time. So when you don't have any cause to question what's going on, as you were suggesting in quoting from Sharon, and things are going in a direction that you describe for yourself as desirable, in other words, your 401k is increasing in value mm-hmm. every year and so forth, it just seems like, yes, all is right with the world. And you can pay your mortgage payments and, you know, maybe buy a bigger house and on and on and on, that this is the way it's supposed to be. And we tell ourselves that this is the way it's supposed to be. And then there are, as Sharon was suggesting, these rude awakenings that happen sometimes. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be the collapse of the economy or the stock market. It can be as simple as, something happening to one of your family members
or
to yourself.
The phone rings. You pick up the phone. You have some news about an illness.
And your whole life is different.
And your whole life is different. Yeah.
Yeah. Whether somebody died or it's a cancer diagnosis or mm-hmm. whatever it is. But we live in a kind of somnambulant expectation that everything will go on the way it is. Do you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And that is certifiably absurd. But that doesn't mean that we won't lull ourselves into a kind of happy trance with that until we're taught differently. Mm-hmm. So to come back to your question, in a sense, we're all in the same boat here now, globally really in some way, but let's just speak about the country and maybe the first world, European countries and, you know,
North America.
Asian, mm-hmm. you know, even, you know, all industrialized
right.
countries, all of a sudden, you know, nobody wants to buy their exports because nobody feels rich anymore. And a lot of it is psychological. I mean, the world hasn't changed that much in the past 6 months, except that what's changed is no one trusts anybody else.
Right.
Nobody has any confidence that the banks will actually, you know, do what banks are supposed to do. In fact, they mm-hmm. weren't doing what they were supposed to do. They were selling you mortgages. Mm-hmm. But then, and if you were selling a mortgage, if you were a bank and you sold somebody a mortgage for a house, you'd want to make sure that they could pay the payments, right? Because otherwise you'd be out on a limb.
Right.
But if you are very clever, you can take that mortgage and cut it up into a million little bits and sell it off as derivatives, and then you have no risk. So then you're motivated to sell houses to people that may not be able to afford them because there's no downside for you.
So I want to ask you zero in on a couple of questions about what you know about stress.
Okay, so you get let me just tie that
okay,
in, though.
All right,
so you
all right,
get
all
right. my point
yeah.
that once you start behaving in that kind of way, you're creating all sorts of conditions that are going to generate a lot of suffering.
Right. Okay.
And, mm-hmm. and so that the stress, if we loop it back to stress and mm-hmm. the whole thing about mindfulness-based stress reduction, is that the stress really has to do with wanting things to stay the same when they are inevitably going to change. The law of impermanence rules the universe. Mm-hmm. And so things are never constant. They're continually changing. And if you want to hold them a particular way, you can do it for short periods of time at tremendous cost, but ultimately things change.
Right.
And if you don't recognize that, then you're going to create a lot of suffering for yourself and other people.
So if I think about the place we're in collectively now, I mean, individually, many of us are experiencing stress either through changes in our job security or,
right,
you know, financial situation or things happening to people close to us.
Yes.
And there's also, I think what's especially difficult about the present moment is there's also anticipatory stress. There's, will it get worse?
The other shoe.
Right? What
yeah,
will
the
happen
other shoe
next?
Waiting for it to drop.
So something I thought was very interesting as I'm reading your work is that, you know, you said that perceived stress is just as bad for you as real.
Yes.
You know, and that you said your body doesn't know the difference. Their body doesn't know that the other shoe hasn't dropped, right?
Right.
If you're spending, so talk to me about that. I think that's very interesting.
Well, if you're telling yourself a story about how horrible things are, even if the story is not quite true, your body is going to relate to it as if it is true, and it's going to pour stress hormones into the bloodstream, cortisol and the like, and you know, your heart rate will go up and your muscles will contract and you'll be, you know, either in a fight or flight mode or in a freeze mode if it's really terrifying. And all of this without really having there be a major threat. It just the thought in the mind is enough to generate that threat.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you're not sort of really intimate with thoughts as thoughts, then every thought that flits through your mind is potentially perceived as actually the truth. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, the thought that I'm not as good as she is. Okay? There's a thought. Or people don't like me. Or I will never succeed. Or I'm over the hill now, or it's all downhill from here, or I'm too old, or I'm too heavy, or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
All of these are just thoughts, but they're not related to as thoughts by most people. They're related to as the absolute truth.
Okay.
So one of the ways in which you can actually deal with all the stress that we're facing, both the real events in our life and also the imagined ones that we create in the mind, is to actually begin to differentiate between thoughts and other aspects of reality. So thoughts are really events in the field of awareness. And the more you can see them as events that arise and pass away, just like your breath arises and passes away and moves into the next breath, all of a sudden you have a completely different perspective on them. And rather than being a prisoner of them, you then have the a lot of ability to actually let them come and go without being caught in the emotional charge of them. And a lot of these thoughts are freighted with very, very intense emotional reactivity.
But and I think that something that feels counterintuitive in this culture, even though maybe it shouldn't, I mean, maybe it's logical, is part of the discipline of mindfulness or the intention of it is, you know, I think that our intuition is, I feel afraid, I feel, you know, I feel terrified, I feel vulnerable, to want to turn away from those feelings. And
right.
But what you do is the opposite, right? You detach from them by facing them, right?
I wouldn't say detach. That's a tricky word because we don't
right.
want to give people the suggestion that that they should dissociate
mm-hmm.
from their feelings, because that is a kind of a coping strategy that a lot of people use when they're experiencing intense trauma.
Mm-hmm.
And while it may be effective to save their life in a particular moment, it is not an effective way to live your life. And so very often people will feel like what we're telling them to do is to, you know, don't trust their thoughts or feelings, which is not what we're saying at all, because you have to, you know, trust yourself and your thoughts and feelings are part of it. But to not see them as true.
You talk about actually
but just evidence.
And you talk about being in wise, compassionate relationship with your pain,
yes,
your
and,
fear.
But to see, yeah, and so let's unpack that for a moment. If whether it's thoughts or whether it's, say, an intense sensation in the body that we would label unpleasant, like pain or something like that, you can do a little experiment, and your listeners can do it even as they're listening. And that is, if you are in a state of anxiety or of pain or distress of any kind, you can bring awareness to it. And a good place to start is in how the body's feeling in the moment, in the present moment. And then ask yourself, is my awareness of fear actually frightened in this moment? Is my awareness of the pain actually suffering in this moment? And when you do that little experiment for yourself, you'll discover that it may not be. In fact, it's very unlikely that it will be. And so you've already given yourself another place to reside, so to speak, another dimension of your being, rather than being caught up in the reactivity around thoughts or intense sensation or intense emotions. You can be the field that knows the arising and passing away of these thoughts and sensations. And there's no suffering. And that there isn't there, by the way. It's here. It's in the present moment. Mm-hmm. So that's why mindfulness is really grounded on the cultivation of intimacy with the present moment, because the past and the future, although very, very important, are really constructs of our ways of thinking. And the only time, the only moment we ever have in which to learn or grow or heal or make anything happen or express love is the present moment, and that usually is the one we ignore the most.
Now, here's another, let's say, superficial, perhaps a confusion or contradiction. I mean, mindfulness is not just is not about thought, right? I mean, your book,
right?
You're very
beautiful. Mean the word mindfulness?
Yeah, the
mindfulness. Like
it sounds like it's about thought. Meditation, I think the stereotype is it's about sitting in your head.
Right.
Your beautiful long book that you wrote just a couple of years, you know, coming to our senses, and you've even pointed out that for the Buddha, that you know, the mind is also a sense, and it is all about being embodied. So talk to me about that and how that can make a difference in a moment like this, where the world around us is so frightening.
Yeah. Well, where to start? We really haven't been educated to realize that there's a certain way, there's a certain faculty that we're born with that is at least as powerful as any of the other faculties that we think about or know that we have, like the ability to think. We've never been trained in the ability to pay attention, for instance. We get yelled at in school for not paying attention,
right,
or when the teacher thinks we're not paying attention. Actually, we are paying attention. It's just as something other than what's on the blackboard or whatever. So attention and awareness are deep interior human capacities that never get any training or airtime or attention. What gets all the attention is thinking. And so when you begin to cultivate intimacy with these other capacities, it actually balances out our remarkable capacity for thinking and also for imagination and creativity. A lot of the creativity comes out of the stillness of awareness in not knowing. So rather than just sort of keeping tabs of what we know, it's really helpful to be aware of how much we don't know. And when we know what we don't know, then, well, that's the cutting edge at which all science unfolds.
Right. You've also said that scientists make the best meditators because they're comfortable with that idea of wanting to know what they don't know.
But you see, it's all a question of thinking. I mean, the word mindfulness, for instance, I completely agree with you. Anybody who's naive to hearing it is going to think, oh, yeah, that's some kind of cognitive manipulation. Yeah. So I like to point out that in all Asian languages, at least I've been told this, I don't know all Asian languages, but in all Asian languages, the word for mind and the word for heart are the same word.
So when you hear
the word mindfulness, if you're not in some sense automatically hearing the word heartfulness, you're misunderstanding it. Mm. And mindfulness, in any event, is not a concept. It's a way of being. And it's a way of being awake. It's not a big deal. It's just that we're never taught that this is part of the human repertoire. So what does wakefulness mean? It means resting in a kind of awareness that is so stable that it's not thrown off by the comings and goings of events within the field of awareness, so that you lose your balance when things go this way and things go that way. But you actually stay grounded when things go your way, as we put it, that doesn't mean like all of a sudden you turn into some kind of obsessed egomaniac narcissist. Mm-hmm. And when things don't go your way, it doesn't mean that you have to rocket yourself or spiral into depression and hopelessness and a sense of despair. But very often, if we take it personally, because the emphasis is on the my way, then we do take things personal and we feel like our successes say that we're a good person. And then by extrapolation, our failures say that there's something wrong with me, that I'm no good. And both of those are wrong. You were good before you were a success, and you're good even though there are failures and they are a normal part of living. What goes up also comes down, whether we're talking about the stock market or a ball that you throw up in the air. And if you mistake what you think is the reality, what you think of as the reality for the reality, then you're going to suffer because you're attaching the story of me, myself, and my successes and my failures to something that's actually quite impersonal. We can easily generate a certain kind of collaborative conspiracy around it so that the bottom line of my 401k becomes like, you know, my worth. Right. And we even have the phrase in, you know, the, you know, sort of personal economics, my net worth, right? Mm-hmm. But our net worth is infinite. It's got nothing to do with the bottom line on some, you know, and I'm not knocking it. I mean, we all need retirement accounts and it would be nice right. if we have more money in it rather than less. And it would be nice if we could afford the houses that we live in and pay for it and that our banks really, we're not, you know, in some sense trying to so maximize their own returns that they forget that this is, you know, one body politic that we're part of. If the heart just goes off and does its own thing or the liver, then basically you've got atrial fibrillation and cancer, and that doesn't do the body as a whole any good. So it's the same for banks and mortgage companies and insurance companies, and we've seen them run rampant, but that's because the head for a very long time said, these organizations and organs, so to speak, of the body politic, they can regulate themselves. They don't need any checks and balances or course regulation. Let's just let capitalism do its trip. And that's the rude awakening, as we now see the disaster that follows in the wake of that kind of thing. And the Buddhists got it right from the very beginning, if you don't mind my looping it back to that.
No.
And this is not about whether you're a Buddhist or not, but they called these three toxins of greed, hatred, and ignorance the core foundation of suffering. Hmm. And it's greed is wanting, just an endless, endless wanting more and more and more, so that no matter how much money you get, the CEOs are getting, you know, sort of salaries that are like beyond imagination. And it's never enough. Or hatred, like, you know, find somebody else to be the enemy or the cause of all my problems and then just direct anger and hatred towards them. Or delusion, which is living in this kind of misapprehension of reality but thinking it is the reality. And all of those are at play so much nowadays that it's almost as if the dark glasses are coming off and every single one of us is getting to see a kind of morality play, if you like, about right. what happens when we stop paying attention and when we don't come to our senses. And so the body politic, whether you think of it as the earth and the environmental crisis and the potential for global warming to really, you know, wreak havoc on the planet for, you know, thousands of years to come and all the future generations, or whether it's the economic crisis or whether it's the social crisis or the education crisis or whatever it is, these are all different organ systems within the one body politic. And we need to start, as the cells of the body politic, start taking responsibility for our own little particular piece of it. And I think if the citizenry, if you will, did that and didn't sort of bifurcate into Republicans and Democrats or conservatives or liberals, and so that, you know, some people like are invested in the president failing because then our team will look better.
Right.
I mean, this is really insane. It's like a cancer of a certain kind growing inside our own body. And it's the, you know what it is? It's the cancer of ignorance. It's the cancer of ignoring certain aspects of reality because we're so driven by the ethic of more for me.
Right.
And me understood in a very small way, so that actually, if you live that way, your own children may not even talk to you,
right,
or may feel like you've betrayed, you know, generations to come by that particular display of really not only mindlessness, but you could say heartlessness.
Right. I think Joseph Goldstein, who's also a great Buddhist teacher, talks about the heart-mind as a better translation. I just want to tether this a little bit. Here's the thing. I think what you said about these, and I hear this from so many different directions in so many conversations I have, that I really
think
it must
be very interesting for you to sit
all
in
your chair
and just talk to all these people.
But, you know, I think that I've come to think of meditation and mindfulness and even yoga as spiritual technologies that these traditions have mined and kept alive and deepened. And as you say, they don't just present themselves in the modern world to Buddhists. They present themselves as keys to sane living.
Yeah, exactly.
And yet, if you want to talk about these spiritual tools, or just these tools of cultivation of your mental states, as accessible to real people in our time. I mean, you know, I've wanted to ask this question to someone for a long time. It seems to me you might be the quick person to ask. I mean, the Buddha left his wife and child behind. And
I'm so glad
right,
you brought that
and
up.
Devoted himself utterly to this pursuit of enlightenment.
Yeah.
Monastics, a lot of the studies, I don't know how much you've been involved in these, but studies that I know you're associated with where they've studied stress on the brain and they've studied monastics and they find that they've really changed their minds. But, you know, they don't pay the rent. They don't live in fear
Absolutely
of being laid
right.
off.
Absolutely right.
Okay.
They are renunciates in a certain way.
Right.
That's, they've renounced the conventional world.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, I mean, but anybody who thinks that's easy should try it for a bit.
Okay.
And you find, like, there's as much stress on that side as there is on any other side. Greed, hatred, and delusion are equal opportunity employers. So just
right.
thinking of yourself as a spiritual person or renouncing the world, easier said than done if you're talking about tapping into some deep dimensionality of peace, well-being, genuine happiness.
Mm-hmm.
But that said, your point is very well taken, and so the real challenge is how do we do it living in this world without having to sort of abandon wife and children or husband and child or whatever and going off for the sake of our own small-minded, if you will, enlightenment. One of the things, I don't know if you know this, but my wife and I wrote a book on mindful parenting.
Yes, I do.
About 12 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that we say in there is, like, of all the spiritual practices, you know, no matter how severe the monastery and how arduous the particular practices associated with it, living with children is probably the most powerful spiritual practice that anybody could ever be engaged in,
mm-hmm.
if you open yourself to it that way.
Spiritual practice
because,
and challenge.
Well, all spiritual practice is challenging
yes.
because you have to deal with your own mind.
Uh-huh.
Never mind. You don't need to worry about other people in a way because your own mind is turbulent and distressed enough. But when you have children, I like to look at them as, when they're little, as little live-in Zen masters that are sort of parachuted into our lives to push all our buttons and
mm-hmm.
see how we're going to work with, you know, the challenges that they throw at us, in addition to, of course, having to put food on the table, pay the rent, build a career, have a loving relationship, you know, that is sustained over time and isn't merely mechanical or perfunctory. And this is like a really tall order.
Mm-hmm.
So what are Americans better at than taking on the full challenge of like all of this kind of stuff? So I really think that in some way, this is the best monastery. It's not a conventional monastery, but, you know, this is the perfect environment in which to cultivate mindfulness and liberative, clarity, wisdom, compassion, working with the tools at our disposal, rather than thinking, I'll leave my family and I'll go off and be in a cave and get enlightened and then I'll come back and rescue everybody.
All right. And you even say that meditation doesn't have to be about finding an hour a day.
No, it's like the real meditation practice is how you live your life from moment to moment.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's easy to say. It's not so easy to do. The key thing about, and the Dalai Lama speaks about this a lot because it's so true, the key thing about meditation practice, and I think you used the word discipline at one point some ways back,
mm-hmm.
the key thing about it is motivation. If you're not motivated to do whatever is required to be in the present moment, you won't be. Thich Nhat Hanh likes to say the reason we need to practice mindfulness is because we're practicing mindlessness virtually 24/7.
Right.
Practice getting angry every time you're frustrated. Well, you get better at it. Practice makes perfect. It really does make perfect. So if you get better at boredom and get better at anger and get better at fear and get better at worry and get better at absorption and get better at multitasking, you'll become like a master of never being where you actually are.
Mm-hmm.
And if you sum that over a lifetime, you may miss the most profound elements of your own life and then blame it on, you know, busyness or the internet or email or something like that. But we're the responsible agents.
So
these are choices that we can make, but you have to have the motivation to do it. Mindfulness is very, very simple, but it's not easy.
I've heard you, though.
Because it requires a certain amount of work to develop.
But, you know, I've heard you when you spoke to some employees at Google. You'll give people a way to think about how it would start, what it would feel like. Would you do that? Mm-hmm. Would you just...
I'm happy
to, exercise.
Long as those of you who are driving in your cars don't close your eyes or go off into outer space. This is about dropping in on the present moment. So what's in front of you through the windshield, very, very important. Staying in your body, very, very important. Mindfulness does not require us to close our eyes. And there are thousands of different ways to cultivate it, but one very good way is to feel a sense of your body as a whole. Now, it turns out that although we're never encouraged to do that, everybody gets that almost immediately to one degree or another. You just see if you can put your awareness in the whole of your body so that it includes the entire envelope of your skin and a sense of the head above the neck and shoulders and the whole of your body, no matter what posture it's in. And just see if you can feel whatever the sensory field of your body as a complete unit is in this moment. One of the things that you'll notice is that within this universe that we call our own body, there are certain features that are hard not to notice, one of which is that it's taking air from the outside and bringing it into the body. And then it's amazingly expelling that air so that another breath can come into the body. And we call this, of course, breathing. And it's doing itself. It's not like we're actually doing it. We say, I'm breathing. But if it was up to that you that was saying I to breathe, you'd have died a long time ago because you would have gotten distracted and forgotten. Whoops.
Right.
Whoops. Dead. So the brainstem takes care of that very, very well for us. And what was being suggested here is that we just feel our breath. Not think about it, but feel it.
So, you know, again, the term that is used for the kind of was kind of what you've brought to medicine, you and others, is the mind-body connection, the mind-body interface. But really, that's not quite big enough, is it? I mean, it still sounds like they're two different things. I mean, because,
yeah.
See, again, there's this kind of paradox when you use a term like awareness,
yeah.
which again sounds like a mental activity, but what you ask people to do and how they become aware is to drop into their bodies and their senses.
Yeah, drop into being. See, we call ourselves human beings. That's a big cliche, but we're more like human doings.
Right.
So we actually haven't had that much experience in inhabiting our own being. it's kind of almost foreign territory. And as soon as we do, we want to fill it up with something. Even if it's, say, looking at a sunset, and then you got to talk about it instantly. Oh, did you see, you're seeing this? Is it as beautiful as I think it is? And all of a sudden, you're not seeing the sunset anymore. You're in your thoughts about the sunset. Mm. So whatever it is, our thoughts very often wind up carrying us away from the heart of the matter. And what these, as you put it, technologies or intrapsychic technologies, whatever you want to call them, offer us is a chance to continually return to what's deepest and best in ourselves. And it's not something you have to get by going to Harvard or working in the vineyards for 20 years. You've already got it. Mm-hmm. And the body's a big part of it. So we often don't appreciate that the body does what it does, whether it's digest food or eliminate waste or any of that, until something goes wrong. And then all of a sudden you realize, oh, my God, I spent 40 years being able to urinate, and all of a sudden now I can't. And then you begin to realize, whoa, do you know what I'm saying? I took that for granted. Right. I take for granted that my eyes work, that my feet work, that I can balance, that I can walk, that I can run, that I can hear. I mean, we're just like walking miracles, but we had so out of touch with it. And that's where the metaphor of and the literal way in which we keep coming back to our senses. Mm. Hearing is a fabulous path for cultivating mindfulness. Mm-hmm. Just hear, and I'm not talking about listening now, I'm talking about hearing. So we're not going out scanning for good things to hear, but just letting whatever sounds are coming to us be heard. A lot of the time, we just tune them out. What we see, a lot of the time, we tune out what we're seeing, especially if we don't like it. We can hug without really being present. We can be out of touch in so many different ways. We can be on autopilot. And so the practice of mindfulness, whether you're doing it in some formal way, meditating in a sitting posture or lying down, doing a body scan or doing mindful hatha yoga. But the real practice is, as I said, is living your life as if it really mattered from moment to moment. The real practice is life itself and coming to all of those senses and hearing, seeing, smelling, tasting, touching, and also we could say minding, which is another way of saying awarenessing. I actually like to use awareness as a present participle. What we're doing is actually awarenessing, okay? Mm. And it puts us in touch with a whole different dimension than thinking. There's nothing wrong with thinking.
Right,
it can be incredibly creative,
it's
and it can also
thinking.
Be incredibly destructive. Mm-hmm. But awareness can't be destructive.
I think, you know, there's a place, I think I wrote this down, there's a place in your book where you just really put a fine point on what's at stake, you know, that any moment in which we're not aware, any moment that we're not attentive to, is lost. I mean,
abandoned your own life.
I mean, there's a quote you have from Thoreau and Walden: "Only that day dawns to which we are awake."
Yeah, it was just at his home site the other day, bringing my German publisher there with his son. Mm. You know, we make pilgrimages to Walden Pond to visit Thoreau. Mm. Only that day dawns to which we are awake. It's the third to the last line in the whole book of Walden. And, you know, this is a realization that he had that you can – and this was even in the 1840s in Concord, which we might think of as idyllic. You know, he was describing the residents of Concord and the farmers as living lives of quiet desperation. So it's not just the email and the internet, and the World Wide Web that are carrying us away from ourselves.
It's the human condition.
Yeah, it's the human condition. Uh-huh. But – I like to point out, if we have a moment for this, Krista, is that we call ourselves Homo sapiens sapiens. That's the species name we've given ourselves. And that means, from the Latin sapere, which means to taste or to know, the species that knows and knows that it knows. So that means really awareness and meta-awareness. And it would be nice if that were actually true, but I think it's a little premature to call ourselves that. And now maybe we need to live ourselves into owning that name by cultivating awareness and awareness of awareness itself. And that let that be, in some sense, the guide as to, you know, what we're going to invest in, how we're going to make decisions about where we live, where we're going to send our kids to school, how we're going to be at the dinner table, whether we're going to watch 5 hours of TV or whether we, you know, fill up all our time, whether we're going to take our bodies and our children and our parents for granted, or whether we're going to live life as if it really mattered moment by moment. Mm-hmm. And that's not to put ourselves in a straitjacket. That would be horrible. This is not some kind of prescription for more stuff that you need to do in order to be happy. This is getting out of your own way long enough to realize that you already have the potential for tremendous well-being and happiness right here, right now. Nothing else has to change.
Yeah, and again,
Just even if you're dealing with a very, very difficult time or dealing with some kind of chronic medical condition, there are ways to be in relationship to it that are more generous to oneself, more accepting, more loving, more kind, and they actually can accelerate and deepen processes of healing and you know, and growing.
And you do work with people who are facing death, right?
Yes.
Who?
Yes. Well, I might say everybody's facing death.
Yes.
Yes.
More imminently and certainly than
Yes. I mean, we work with people with a wide range of different chronic medical conditions, as well as just, you know, your basic stress of living, mm-hmm. which is just getting worse and worse.
Yeah.
And our perspective is that, you know, it's not about dying, it's about living. So can we live our way into our moments? None of us know how many more we have to live. But if we were to start making use of them, one thing it does is it really slows down time. When you're in the present moments, time really stops.
Well, that's interesting because time is something none of us have enough of now, isn't it?
Exactly. Nobody has any time.
That's huge.
So we fill up our lives with everything so that we couldn't possibly even taste the present moment. But there are ways to learn, and this is what the cultivation of mindfulness is. You drop into the present moment. It's like conventional time lengthens. And you can be so much more in touch with, say, let's say, and just take an example, how easy it is to leave the house without making eye contact in the morning when you're on your way to work. It doesn't actually take any more time to make eye contact or say goodbye or hug, you know, your children or whatever it is. But we often feel so rushed that we're blasted out of the house.
I was going
to
say,
what I'm talking about?
I've been yelling at my children for 10 minutes.
Goodbye,
to
I'm
get
out
in
of
the
here.
Car,
adios. So. Or yell at them
I'm
to get
sure
in the car.
I'm not sure they want me to make eye contact.
Well, exactly. You know, so we're so stressed that we're stressing out the children and, you know, sort of like, or whatever it is that, but it actually, and the mind says, I don't have any time. I don't have any time. I don't have any time for this. Mm-hmm. But actually, that's all you have time for is this, because there's nothing else than this. So when your four-year-old can't decide which dress she wants to wear, that's not a problem for you unless you make it a problem for you. That's just the way four-year-olds are. Mm-hmm. And the more we can sort of learn these lessons, the more we will not be in some sense running towards our death but in a sense opening to our lives. And there's a huge distinction between the two, and all the scientific evidence is suggesting that when you choose life in the way I'm talking about, your brain changes in both form and function, your immune system changes, your body changes. I mean, we start to really take care of what's most important, and there are very, very tangible results at the level of the body and the mind and the heart, and most importantly, our relationships mm-hmm. with the world and with our loved ones and with our own bodies.
I want to spend a little time
with
you.
Is this making any sense?
No, it's great. Yes, it's great. We're having a real mm-hmm. conversation. You've been saying some very interesting things about the digital revolution. That we are saddled with a Stone Age mind in a digital world, and that has huge repercussions. Something interesting to me is, as I talk to people about taking stock of some of the larger implications of what's gone wrong in our economy and how we want to live differently beyond this, mm-hmm. is people saying, I need to take control of technology. Not that technology is a bad thing, mm-hmm. but that somehow we feel that it has taken over
yeah.
What are you thinking about that?
Well, I'm struggling with it like everybody else.
Yeah.
I mean, we're the guinea pig generation.
What do you mean by that?
Well, in my lifetime, there was only the analog world. And now, at a certain point in the late 90s, I think, you know, really for most of us, it became digital with the World Wide Web and, you know, all of that. So this is a gigantic experiment that's never happened before on the planet. Everybody who's born more recently, they've only experienced the digital world,
yes,
not the analog world,
yes,
at least talking about our country. So we do. I agree with you. I think we need to let that be, in some sense, an object of attention. We need to hold that in awareness and see how much the technology is improving our lives, which it certainly is doing.
Yes.
Versus how much the technology is turning us into slaves of the technology, which it is certainly doing in a certain way, because the technology is seductive. I don't know if you've noticed that, but it can be very seductive and addictive.
Mm-hmm.
And after a while, between BlackBerries and pagers and, you know, and laptops and this and that, first of all, just let's consider the what we used to quaintly call the work week.
Yes.
There's no end to the work week.
Right.
There's no beginning to it. There's no end to the work day or the beginning of the work day.
Mm-hmm.
So we can work 24/7 everywhere. IBM brags about this in their advertisements.
Right.
When IBM goes digital, you know, the workplace is everywhere. Yeah, great. Except that life isn't merely working.
And is that kind of what you mean also when you say, I mean, technology makes this 24/7 reality possible, but in fact our bodies, our bodies and our minds and our spirits aren't designed.
Exactly. They are
to do 24/7.
And they
okay.
are, that's what I meant by a Stone Age body, you know, and a Stone Age mind in a Space Age world. So we have, we're in a transition here. And I'm not knocking the technology. I'm not saying, you know, sort of like we should go back. You know, I'm not taking a Luddite
mm-hmm.
position on this.
Mm-hmm.
I think the technology is incredibly beautiful, and it's going to get more and more and more powerful and more beautiful. But there are issues associated with it that have to do with the technology is, in some sense, getting more sophisticated than our understanding of ourselves as human beings.
Yes.
Without the technology. And what I'm saying is that the technology is going to wind up changing us as human beings. And people talk about, like, you know, what the future of this technology is when things will be so small that actually you'll, you know, your computers, you'll swallow it, you know, and it will do things inside, like, you know, you'll swallow your doctor or whatever, and they'll
right.
fix you from the inside. Or,
right.
you know, nanotechnology and all of that kind of stuff, and then robotics. And, you know, we're moving towards a very strange, you know, world in some ways, at least so far that we don't know what it's going to be. But one piece of it hasn't developed yet, and that is our intimacy, our deep understanding of what it means to be human. We're still in, you know, our infancy as a human species. And before we start to talk about wet-dry interfaces where you'd start putting chips inside of the skull, for instance, to regulate certain things or upgrade our memory or whatever it is that might seem so attractive, that we really, in the next few generations, need to reclaim the full dimensionality of our humanity, much of which is going to be, in some sense, discovered globally on a massive scale for the first time. There have always been people who have, in some sense, recognized that, and we usually call them saints.
Right.
But
right.
what if everybody's a saint? What if everybody is the Buddha? What if everybody is Jesus in the incarnation of the loving heart, the sacred heart? What then? And you see, I think that's something that we really need to contemplate, because everybody is actually Buddha according to Buddha's teachings, at least in potential. Everybody is, you know, Jesus, at least, you know, in potential. And the recognition of that as all being a flowering of the divine or the sacred, whatever language you want to impose upon it, we haven't really done that yet as a species. We haven't lived up to the name Homo sapiens sapiens. And my point is that maybe the technology will be a kind of mirror in which we can look and remind ourselves that there are aspects of being human and being analog that we don't want to give up to machines when they get smart enough to, you know, maybe pretend that they have feelings or look like they have feelings or they're so bloody faster at calculations and computations than we are that we begin to feel insecure or inadequate in the face of our computers.
You know, when you talk about it this way and when you talk about us being the first generation and being in kind of an experiment, it brings me back to something we were talking about early on, just a core Buddhist insight that we have to have a compassionate relationship with those things that are difficult, right? With our fear,
yes.
But also I'm thinking with the stress that this moment of rapid change, this new territory, creates just by virtue of being new territory.
Absolutely. And, you know, this is far too serious a matter to take too seriously. So it really has to be leavened with humor and a sense of humor.
Okay,
and
that's good.
And really, I mean, I'll sound like I'm joking if I say I'm so serious that, you know, I'm serious about this, but it's too serious to take that seriously.
You know,
so,
yeah, keep going.
You know, it's an ongoing engagement, so to speak. It's like we're part of this experiment, and since it's happening, in a sense, I think all of us, to whatever degree, and each in our own unique way, are being called upon to find out who we are and to live that authentically in the service of this world, not just for our own particular small-minded gain or benefit. And I see that happening, you know, on a very, very vast scale.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, obviously nobody can understand fully what's going on at the moment. But the very idea that mindfulness would be of interest now as broadly as it is in the society and that the number of papers with the word mindfulness in the title in the scientific literature is going exponential.
Mm-hmm.
And the amount of funding that is funding research in mindfulness, the NIH, is going exponential.
And the fact medical education is training to encompass this.
It's also being brought into the military.
Mm-hmm.
It's being brought into business.
Mm-hmm.
It's being brought into professional sports. And
mm-hmm.
I mean, from the perspective of 30 years ago, this is basically inconceivable. And yet it's already happened. And I think it's part of a much larger phenomenon where maybe as a species, because of all the crises we're facing, we are in some sense tapping into that deep human capacity for waking up at the last moment and doing something right.
And
you
these
know,
resources that, in fact, have been cultivated in places for thousands of years.
Exactly. And learning how to tap into them in a big way.
And, you know, it occurs to me also, I mean, let's say I'll start this from another direction, you know, thinking about the stress that is created by technology along with the advancement. I was having a conversation with someone who's involved in the field of neuroeconomics. Have you heard of that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yes.
And so one of the things they talk about is that there is a natural human inclination to empathy. But one of the things that dampens that is stress. I mean, they can see that happening in the brain.
Right. And they can run different scenarios where they stress people out and see how they behave.
And I kind of connected some dots, and I don't know if this is just me, but I think one of the questions we're asking ourselves in this culture right now is, it seems like all along the line, not just at the top levels of finance, but all along the way, people were making decisions that were irresponsible to themselves or to others, you know, mortgage lenders.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it made me wonder if one of the consequences of the rapid technological advance just of the last 10 years is this 24/7 war reality, which is very stressful for us as human beings, and that possibly just that that the stress of this culture that we've created so quickly led us, you know, had this very real and devastating implication of being, of making us make less moral decisions and then real economic consequences. And in that
sense... Well, I think you may have something there. I mean, I still think that that actually greed played a huge amount, a huge role in it. Mm-hmm. That it was just like free money.
Right.
And wasn't so stressful. I mean, they were creating stress down the road for other people, but not so much for themselves. Yes, they're leading a stressful life, but it can also be, and this is one of the dangers and why it's so addictive, is it's intoxicating. You begin to feel powerful, sometimes extremely powerful, because you can make so many decisions in such a rapid sequence and then see almost immediately the positive consequences of them for yourself. And it's the kind of thing where you really can get addicted to it. And I think then you lose all sense of moral judgment, compassion, even, you know, just clarity, and become sort of entrained into a mind state that really is deluded. And whether it's, you know, I think that these things are so complicated. There are many, many different ways to describe this unfolding. I think, to come back to your original point, we're at a point, and I think the people in the White House have a sense of that, that it is possible to use this horrific situation that we find ourselves in so many ways as a profound opportunity for reminding ourselves as a country of what's most important. Then that would include, of course, putting checks and balances in place. Our whole country is predicated on checks and balances.
Right.
We don't have a king or a queen. We have three branches of government, and they're supposed to balance each other. And what the Congress did was systematically undo a whole bunch of checks and balances under the pressure of huge lobbying interests, so that, as I said, this sort of thing would regulate itself. It's like the, you know, the foxes in the chicken coop. You know, they'll take care of all the regulation, and you see what happened. And this has happened time and time and time again in history. And I think we have a very short attention span and even shorter memory. So the real challenge here is, as you posed it at the beginning, are we going to learn something that's going to really set us on another path, or will it just be another recycle of the same old, same
right,
old?
And I think that's a big question, isn't it? And I suppose that's where these kinds of
But that's where mindful leadership, you see, comes in.
Can
you
make
know,
a
it's
difference.
Like you say, Obama seems like a much more mindful president than any president we've had so far, at least that I've had exposure
to. Yeah, that's interesting,
and,
isn't it? That's
you know, context. And so who knows what that will mean? I mean, mindful doesn't necessarily mean perfect, doesn't even necessarily mean great. You know, it just means that there's some degree of awareness and sort of a deep understanding of interconnectedness that is dealing with an emotional intelligence, thank you, that is in fact being brought to bear on these very, very intractable problems, that once the system, you know, gets into this kind of atrial fibrillation, it's very, very hard to get it stabilized.
Let me ask you this. You've talked about this kind of thing and worked on the basics of mindfulness at places like Google or MIT, or you worked with the U.S. rowing team, congressional staff, other businesses. Is there, what do I want to ask? Is there a, are there different questions or different approaches that you need to take in these different kinds of settings to talk about this? Are there different challenges in different realms in talking about this or getting this across?
I think that there are certain ways in which you have to be very, very attuned to who you are speaking to, who you are working with in terms of an audience. So, and then there are other principles that are really more universal. And, you know, it's just as I was saying about the stress reduction clinic, everybody has a body. So whether you're in Congress or in the White House or in prison, you still have a body. You're still breathing. So there are some basic places that we – and you still have a mind, and the mind is usually out of control and addicted and reactive and, you know, all of that. So there's certain fundamental ways in which, no matter what your status in life is, We ground it in the actuality of the here and now. You know, it gets pretty basic. But if you're going to be working with Olympic rowers, you have to frame it so that it makes sense for them. Otherwise, they won't practice or they won't understand what you're trying to offer as a kind of potentially competitive edge. The same would be true if you're dealing with economists or if you're dealing with business leaders or whatever it is, that it has to be framed in such a way that it's in their language. And very often in business, for instance, stress is not the primary language. People who are leaders in business, they're not that interested in stress. They're interested in innovation. They're interested in creativity. They're interested in authentic leadership.
I loved something you said at Google, that that the key to creativity is cultivating more spaciousness in the mind.
Well, actually, there's plenty of spaciousness in the mind already. I probably misspoke or wasn't really thinking about it. But the spaciousness is already in the mind. We can't cultivate it. What we can cultivate is intimacy with it so that we actually know how spacious and how luminous and how creative and how reliable our own minds are. Now, that'd be good to start learning in kindergarten.
Right. And then that does raise a question about education and how some of these, as you said at the very beginning, very common sense ideas might become known to people, become accessible. And, you know, you wrote your book on mindful parenting, I think, before the invention of Facebook and Twitter. So, right?
That's
mean,
true.
Parents and educators have a whole new set of challenges these days in terms of just attention.
You're not kidding. You're not kidding. yes, and again, I think the children are going to wind up teaching us.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to really try to understand the world from their point of view.
Mm-hmm.
And that, of course, is a big challenge because we're the ones that are supposed to know everything and be the authorities.
Right.
And so I think one of the problems that we get into often with our children is that we are driven by a certain kind of fear that if we don't sort of take a very, very strong stand on certain things, then our children will grow up, you know, not understanding certain key things having to do with ethics or morality or fair play or things like that.
Right.
And, of course, those are very, very important. But I think sometimes we actually don't trust the inner intelligence and goodness and kindness of our children and let them teach us as we also nurture and help them grow into who they actually are.
Mm-hmm.
This is a very, very delicate and creative dance. Every child is different. Every, you know, family is different. It continually, continually changing. But as I said, I see it as one of the most profound spiritual practices that is available to us.
Mm-hmm. We just
going to work is another one.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, absolutely. We just got a few more minutes, and I'm aware of that. You've said that you're not Buddhist, although a lot of what you are teaching and working with is
No, I didn't. I said I'm not a Buddhist.
You're not a Buddhist. All right.
Yeah.
I just want. Okay. So
I have to be very particular about that.
All right. Well, what do you? And I just wondered: is there are there other resources or traditions or ways you want to describe yourself that
self-describe?
Yeah.
Well, you know, I guess one way that I've been trying to talk about mindfulness is to kind of get across the point that the problem with self-description isn't the description, it's the self behind the description. And it's usually too small. So
yes.
If I say, you know, I am a Buddhist, the problem isn't with the Buddhist. It's with the I and who I think I am when I'm using
okay.
that personal pronoun.
All right.
I quote something in in Wherever You Go, There You Are, which is a young woman coming home and, you know, sort of disclosing to her parents after she'd gone off to college that she was a Buddhist, and it drove them insane. But then she realized that, and she said this, when I'm a Buddhist, it drives my parents crazy, but when I'm a Buddha, nobody bats an eye. Mm-hmm. You know, so part of it is like there's a certain way in which all self-descriptions are inadequate. And so I try to stay away from them. That's why I don't use the word spiritual even.
Okay.
But I've got one for you because I know you're fishing for some way to nail me down.
No,
subject.
I'm not necessarily.
So I'm going to give you one, okay? And
I
self-describe as a human being.
All right.
That's good enough for me.
All right, we'll give you that. Just one last.
And I love it.
And I think you're pretty good at it too. Just one last. You spoke about you had your scientist father and your painter mother, and
yes,
and somehow you feel that the perceived disconnect or the differences in them made you want to reconcile and maybe made you more open to something like mindfulness. And it seems to me, you know, you poetry is clearly very important to you. You use a lot of it in your writing.
Yes,
it seems to me in your work. I mean, you have. What I wanted to say is, you know, you said at the beginning that science and being a scientist and being a painter don't have much in common, but in fact, at some very deep levels, they do have very intriguing.
Oh, absolutely!
Intriguing.
I wasn't saying they don't have much in common.
No, but on the surface, yes. But when you find those intriguing echoes between
yes.
those kinds of pursuits,
yeah.
so
then you find the unity.
You find, yeah. Do you have you come to? Would you say at this? Yeah. How would you talk at this point about that unity? What that looks like?
Well, you know, since you mentioned poetry, perhaps rather than talk about it in a cognitive way, I'll give you a couple of lines of poetry.
Okay.
Some from Derek Walcott and some from T.S. Eliot, and leave it at that.
All right.
It's I think better to point to it rather than to try to make some definitive prose statement about it, which mm-hmm. is bound to be inadequate and incomplete. So Derek Walcott is a Nobel laureate from the island of St. Lucia, Nobel laureate in literature. And one of my favorite poems of his is called Love After Love. And I'll just give it to you if
yes,
it's okay.
Please. Mm-hmm.
It's not very long. But it really hinges around just this issue of who we are and how much we split ourselves apart. The time will come, he says, the time will come when with elation you'll greet yourself arriving at your own door, in your own mirror, and each will smile at the other's welcome and say, sit here, eat. You will love again the stranger who was yourself. Give wine, give bread, give back your heart to yourself, to the stranger who has loved you all your life, who you have ignored for another, who knows you by heart. Take down the love letters from the bookshelf, the photographs, the desperate notes. Peel your own image from the mirror. Sit, feast on your life. So you see, that's the unity. That's the kind of bringing together all these different sort of fragments of self and recognizing that you will love again the stranger that you pushed away, your true self, the stranger who was yourself. And then T.S. Eliot at the very, very end of the four quartets in Little Gidding, which is the fourth of the quartets, in that famous last stanza that starts, we shall not cease from exploration, and the end of all our exploring will be to arrive where we started and know the place for the first time. Further down there, he gives us an image and then ends with a final image, which is an image of unity that, you know, the thinking mind is never going to wrap its mind around completely, and a beautiful way to end, I think, the greatest poem of his life. Mm. So picking up in the middle of the stanza, he says, quick, now. Okay, he says, not known because not looked for, but heard, half heard in the stillness between two waves of the sea. Quick, now, here, now, always, a condition of complete simplicity, costing not less than everything. And all shall be well. And all manner of things shall be well when the tongues of flame are enfolded into the crowned knot of fire, the tongues of flame are enfolded into the crowned knot of fire and the rose are one. Hmm. And the science and the art are one. And you and the world are one. And the mind and the heart are one. And the mind and the body. You get my drift.
Right, right, right.
So this is a very, very powerful issue that you're pointing at. And mm-hmm. I think it lives inside of all of us. And that's one of the reasons that the great poets are so powerful, is that they give voice to basically they put in words what's basically impossible to put into words, what's unspeakable.
Okay.
And there's an art to that that is just transcendent. Mm. And it nurtures us in ways that bring out our own luminosity and make us rise in some way into the possibility of that unity.
Mm. All right. We have to quit because the studio they need the studio. But
I understand.
Absolutely love this. And I thank you so much for making this time. And
it's my supreme honor to be on your show, Kristen. I think that, I love the questions that you've asked, and it's just been a delight for me to be in conversation with you.
Well, thank you. And I suspect that our paths will cross in person one day, and I look forward to that.
I hope so.
Yeah. Okay.
So thank you very much for the invitation.
All right. Bye-bye. Bye.